tavern. Sit down, rest, have a drink, and listen.
Oh, hey, you must be new around here. My name's Giuliano.
I'm Siggy.
And you're welcome at the Magic Tavern.
Yes, seems like it's your first time here, so why don't we introduce ourselves a little bit?
Yeah, why not? We're a little podcast about Magic the Gathering. We started as a German podcast. We switched after maybe a year, it was almost a year,
yeah.
To English to reach more people.
Yeah, we're kind of trying to bring you all some more entertainment and hopefully also a bit of education.
And bad puns.
Mostly bad puns, though, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, just for the beginning, what do we do?
Yeah, as we said, we are the Magic Tavern. We mostly do limited, standard, and the occasional Commander episode.
Exactly. What you won't find by us or at us is Modern and Legacy, just because we don't know a thing about Modern and Legacy, and it would consume too much time to study all this. So we just focus on, as you said, Standard, Limited, and EDH.
Yep. And I guess you could also say that we do like Magic news in general. So if there's anything going on in the Magic scene, or if Wizards did a thing again, then we'll probably talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. Bannings. When bannings happen, we also talk about the Modern bans. We try to understand what happened there, but as we said, we don't know a thing about Modern, so we just talk.
Yeah. Or maybe it would be more precise to say that we don't actively play the format.
Yeah, so we understand what happens if we read it and read a little bit at Reddit or something like that. But, I don't know the meta of Modern. I don't know what is really played there. So,
Yeah, that's what we do. And who are we? Tell everyone, who are you?
Who am I? Well, I'm Giuliano. I'm from Germany. we are from Bavaria, actually. And no, we don't wear Lederhosen. Not at the moment.
I haven't worn one in like almost 20 years, I think.
Yeah. I play Magic since 2015, I think.
Yeah.
Not so long. I just stumbled upon a bunch of friends who played a little bit kitchen table Magic, and I thought, so hey, that looks like fun. And I've heard about Magic 10 years ago, and it's still played. So why not give it a try? Construction box costs I think 18 euros or like this.
Yeah,
20 at most. And I thought, just have a look, and here I am, spending all my earnings on Magic the Gathering, almost.
Yeah, that's not even a... Jesus, that's not even an understatement.
Yeah, I mean, what I also do is unboxings for the YouTube channel.
Yeah.
We did the last unboxing in English, just to give it a little start. For the English Magic Tavern, and I will continue that. And since I am the working one here, you're studying, I can afford that. So I will buy at least three boxes each set, and maybe if I earn more, I will buy a case. So there's a lot to unbox in the future.
Definitely, yeah. Our last unboxing was, I think, three boxes of Aether Revolt and a bundle and a box of Eternal Masters.
Oh, yeah, the Eternal Masters was from both of us. So the Aether Revolt and a bundle was mine, but Eternal Masters was from both of us. So, and we pulled a Force of Will in the second pack.
Yeah, that was nice.
That was awesome.
It's in my Teferi deck now, actually.
Yeah. Who are you, Ziggy?
Who am I? I'm myself, first and foremost. No, some people may already know me if they're part of the online EDH scene. I also go by the names of Lobster on Discord. I'm the admin of the Play EDH Discord channel, where you can play paper EDH via webcam.
Yeah, I'm part of that community too, by the way. And you have also our own YouTube channel with a bunch of your friends from the Discord channel?
Yes, precisely. I also take part in the Laboratory Maniacs YouTube channel, where we upload competitive multiplayer EDH gameplay and deck techs every Monday.
Yeah, so you see, we are working hard on delivering content, and we hope that you enjoy it.
Yeah.
As much as we do.
So let's take a quick look at what we've got planned for today.
Oh yeah, just for the start, every day we just go through the agenda and list what we will talk about. So at first, what is on the first point?
Yeah, we've actually done the first point already. That's our introduction.
Yeah, introduce ourselves. Check.
Yes. Now, moving on to the second point, we're going to be talking about the Modern Masters 2017 box art that was released. And we're also going to talk about some of the things from Armonkhet that we saw, like pictures of the five gods, or two pictures that were released that are probably the Planeswalker decks for Armonkhet. And we're going to talk about the promo full art basic lands that quite honestly look very stunning.
Oh yeah, just we will link everything under our cast, so we have a link for everything we talk about, and just look at these full art basic lands. They're beautiful. In the background, if you noticed, surely the background is always the sign of Bolas.
Yes, the two
horns. They're the horns of Bolas.
Pretty much. It's quite nice. I do like them a lot, and I hope that since they're going to be in boosters, they'll also get foil versions. That would be nice.
Well, just start with Modern Masters for the beginning.
Hang on. That's not the only thing we're doing today. We've got well over an hour of podcasting left. after that, since we had taken a bit of a break for like 2 weeks because I got quite sick, we're going to be talking about why Mardu Vehicles did as well as it did at the Pro Tour, and why we are not seeing it as much anymore after the Pro Tour.
Oh yeah, I can totally just forgot the word, damn it. I can say it from first hand why that it doesn't appear as much anymore, because I was at a game day in Augsburg. It's like 30 kilometers from here. There was no Mardu Vehicles. Nobody wanted to build a Mardu Vehicles deck. There was one red-white vehicles deck, but that was it. The rest was green-black, just obviously because it's very strong.
Yeah.
And a totally stupid
Aetherflux
Reservoir deck.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, he totally annihilated me. not a glimpse of chance at with him. That was just stupid.
Such a good deck. I love it.
Yeah.
All right. And finally, we are going to do a thing that we do a lot, which is we take a current popular deck list or a deck list that's about to become popular, just going by trends. We're going to take a good look at it and analyze it a bit, talk about how it matches up against different other established decks, all of that good stuff.
Yeah, what we like, what the creator built around it, or what he put in there, what we like, or maybe what we don't like, what we don't understand, mm-hmm. what he could have made better. But yeah, that's what we do.
All right, so let's jump right into it. Modern Masters 2017. The first thing to note is that people have not really been happy about the whole ordeal, because...
Yeah, the package artwork is spoiled, and yeah, you can... I'm not happy either. I'm not interested in Modern Masters myself, but I can understand why the people are so salty about it. And come on, first artwork is Domri Raid. I mean, he's a cool guy, but why in Modern Masters... A set that is ridiculous expensive.
Yeah, it's... I think the thing that people don't particularly like about it is that Modern Masters, or the philosophy behind Modern Masters, is to make Modern more accessible and more affordable for people. If Wizards then decide to put a lot of cards into Modern Masters that just don't see Modern play at all, like, for instance, Domri Raid, then they're not quite hitting the mark.
Yeah, and if we look at the second artwork, Griselbrand, he is played, but to be honest, not very expensive.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense. It doesn't change a thing.
Precisely. Griselbrand is a cool card, definitely, and I would love to see him unbanned in Commander, because he is super good. But it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, Griselbrand already had two printings, and he wasn't expensive. Like, he's a below $10 mythic.
Yeah. And, oh yeah, the third artwork is just... What the actual fuck?
Yeah, that one, I think, is the biggest miss out of all of them. It's Stoic Angel.
It's not even a good EDH card.
Yes, precisely.
What... come on.
For the people who don't know what it does, it's basically a 4 mana, 1 and in banned colors, 3/4 flyer that doesn't allow people to untap more than one creature each turn. So basically a creature Winter Orb. It costs like, I think, 20 cents on Magic Card Market. And yeah, in my opinion, that's another card that just should not be representative of this kind of set.
Yeah, maybe... I can understand if they put such cards in there for limited balancing, because every set has to be limited playable.
Definitely, yeah.
That's okay, and it's a cool thing, but not this card. Please don't.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that Wizards should probably understand how to hype their sets by now. They've done it for over 20 years, I mean.
Yeah, so, I thought they absolutely hit the mark with the Tunnel Masters.
Yes.
With the Force of Will artwork. They spoiled it at the first card set. There is a Force of Will in there, and this is the new artwork. And then you look at the Tunnel Masters, at the box artwork, and you see, yes, there's a Force of Will in it.
Yeah, precisely. The first two cards from Eternal Masters were Force of Will and Wasteland, which were probably, with the exception of Rishadan Port, the two most wanted reprints for all of Legacy. And now they're hitting us with Modern Masters. They've promised to do things from the original Innistrad block and Ravnica.
So we will probably see Liliana of the Veil, maybe?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, like Snapcaster Mage, Liliana of the Veil.
Because these are expensive cards that are played in tier 1 decks in Modern, and
yes,
nobody wants to spend, I don't know, 200, 300 euros on a playset of this card.
Precisely, especially if it's for Modern, which was originally meant to be an, I'll paraphrase here, affordable Eternal format.
Yeah, now it's just absolutely...
Rather, non-rotating rather than Eternal, but...
Yeah, it's... But it should be affordable. And
yes.
If I have to spend a lot, around 2,000 euros on a stupid deck...
Yes, some...
I don't understand it. I understand why Legacy and Vintage is expensive.
Yeah.
Because they are really expensive cards that are seeing no printing anymore.
Yeah, thanks to the reserved list, but we probably shouldn't go into that right now because
but
terrible topic.
Maybe you understand now why Modern Masters is a letdown at the moment.
Yes. Now, I've already heard some people say that, tinfoil time here, that Wizards is intentionally not marketing Modern Masters properly because they want to stop making the sets. I have no idea if that's true or why that would be true. I'll just throw it out there because people have been saying it.
Yeah, so if it's true, we said it too. And yeah, I hope it's not true. I mean, as we said, we don't play Modern, but it would be just a shame if a format got annihilated like that.
Yeah.
Just wiped out from the surface of Magic. That's not good.
Definitely not. Alright, let's move on to Brighter Pastures here.
Yeah.
Amonkhet. It looks cool, definitely, at first look. You know, we've got some cool artworks for the five gods that were talked about in the initial Amonkhet reveal, with the whole Trial of the Five Gods thing and everything. And we've got some nice artworks here of a cat, a crane, a crocodile.
An Anubis dog, like, yep. And a snake. A snack lord.
Yes, because...
snacks are good.
As evidenced by the current standard metagame.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the artwork is really gorgeous.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Look at the Anubis. I think this is really nice.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. I like those artworks a lot, and...
we have the Planeswalker artworks. Good. Okay, Nissa... I don't understand it. Nissa is a really cool character, and because of that, she is an elf. You can do a lot of things with her, but almost... I would say 50% of her artwork is just garbage.
A human with long ears.
Yeah, just absolutely garbage.
Oh, well.
But Liliana looks, as always, just really chill. Like, whatever.
Yeah, and we've got Gideon right here, who seems to have aged by, like, 30 years after Battle for Zendikar block. I mean, if you compare this artwork to his artwork on the Ally of Zendikar card...
Oh, yeah. He looks... I wouldn't say he aged 30 years. He's just more battle scarred.
I mean, that's probably what it is, but... on the Ally of Zendikar card, you've got him as, like... He looks like someone who's in his mid-20s and, like, at the height of human performance, so to say... And now we're looking at this guy, and, like, he's got creases on his skin, and, like, a fucking... I don't even know.
Yeah. the arch-enemy, or arch-enemy?
Oh, yeah, arch-enemy.
Arch-enemy, Nicol Bolas. That's a cool thing. They didn't do that for a long time, I think. When was the last arch-enemy
bundle? That's a good question.
But it's cool. If you look at the artwork, we have Nicol Bolas as the arch-enemy. And three decks, one Gideon, Nissa, and Chandra? Yeah, that's a Chandra. And I think that would be really nice. I mean, Bolas is Grixis colors.
Mm-hmm.
So we have blue and black. And we have to cover the other colors. Red is obviously there too. But we have to cover them too. So we have white with Gideon, green with Nissa, and red with Chandra. So it's really well made.
That definitely makes sense. Arch Enemy is a very interesting format, but unfortunately, a lot of the times when I play Commander, I already get to play Arch Enemy. So I've got my fill of that.
Yep. The full art basic lands. They're really beautiful, but what is a little bit of a letdown, to be honest, is that you find them in, you find one in every fourth pack. So
yeah,
they're a little more scarce.
That is true. On one hand, it is a bit of a letdown because they're not going to be as widely accessible as the Battle for Zendikar ones. But on the other hand, I feel like it also kind of makes sense in a way because full art lands are, let's say, a bit of a delicate thing. You don't want to flood people with special or cool cards like that, because if you do that, then they'll just stop being special.
Yeah, you can see it one way or the other, but yeah. They're back. It's a nice thing, and I hope that they will be foiled once.
It would be nice.
Yeah.
I also hope that this is going to be something that they're going to start doing regularly, because people have wanted promo basic lands back for quite a while, and Wizards have finally listened, which is quite nice.
Yeah. What we can talk about, what is not mentioned here, but I think I have heard it, in every block they will do these ultra mythics, they said, I think. You know, the inventions, the,
yeah.
What was it, the expeditions,
masterpieces,
the expeditions. And this one, I think they want to do something like based around enchantments.
I have heard people saying that, but I haven't seen it confirmed anywhere.
Yeah, but just to say that, it's not mentioned here, so we have to wait if something comes. But I think they said they want to do it every block.
Yeah, I do remember them saying that. It is going to be a thing that they're going to do basically every time moving forward.
Yeah, it's a logical thing on the economical side, because you want people to open the shit out of these boxes, to be honest, and it's okay. It's not hurting the market. It's just, I would say, it's it made standard more accessible, because the regular cards are going to be cheaper, and yeah, you get your masterpieces, your expeditions, and whatever they will print here.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a good solution to the standard affordability problem, and to be quite honest, I'm fairly sure that most people like it when there's just a chance of having a random $100 bill in your booster pack.
That's why I like to open boxes.
Precisely.
Yep.
I also think it would make sense for this set of masterpieces to be enchantments, because we've got gods on here, and if we go back to Theros' block, then we can see that the gods were originally enchantment creatures.
Yeah, I hope they don't repeat that for that block, because then the Theros gods are not unique anymore. But I hope they find a unique solution for these gods. Maybe a trial enchantment, trial of blah blah blah, and then it does something special. I don't know.
Possibly. Although, I think I would like to have them be somewhat similar to Theros gods.
Yeah, absolutely. They have to be, how do I say that, enormous beings. They have to be absolutely special and outstanding, but not an exact copy of Theros gods. That would
No, not necessarily that.
Yeah.
But the reason why I think that way is that I feel like devotion is actually a thing that quite nicely captures the essence of what a god is. So if you have a god on a plane, then you can feel its presence without having it actually be there. That's how some of the Theros gods work. You have them on the field as an enchantment. They're not an actual present creature, but their effect is still being felt. Now, if you build your deck in a certain way that you have devotion, both in a literal and a figurative sense, then the presence of that god becomes stronger and it becomes a creature and it's actually there and so on.
Yeah, I think maybe if the gods are multicolored, it would be just enough to be two-colored. Then you could make a devotion for two colors and then it would be
that
unique.
That
again.
Is what they did. Theros Block had 5 monocolored gods.
Really?
And 10 dual-colored gods, yeah.
Oh, okay. I forgot
and,
that.
People are speculating that the 5 gods here are going to be tricolored in Shard's colors. So Grixis, Esper, Bant, Naya, and which one am I forgetting?
Don't know anymore. But it would make absolutely sense because Bolas is Grixis. So
yeah.
If there are tricolored themes, then it would be around Shards, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
That would be nice.
Yeah, so we have the Planeswalker decks.
Maybe, right.
There's not much to talk about because there's only the artwork, no text. But, yeah, the one is Gideon, the other is Liliana. So,
yeah,
we know we will get a Gideon Planeswalker in Amonkhet and a Liliana Planeswalker in the first set.
Yeah, and I'd be willing to speculate that there's going to be a Nissa Planeswalker considering we've got an artwork for her, but I'm not sure if it's going to be in the first or the second set.
Yeah, maybe not a Nissa, because the last Nissa was in Kaladesh in the first set. That would be too... not much time between them.
I don't know. I mean, I still feel like it's entirely possible. Because... So, I think it's going to work if she's in the second set. Because, for instance, we had...
Liliana was in
Eldritch Moon.
Eldritch Moon, so it would make sense, yeah.
Also, we've had Oath of the Gatewatch Nissa, and then Kaladesh Nissa, which means there's 2 sets in between. So if we have Kaladesh Nissa, and we have Hour of Devastation Nissa, there's also 2 sets in between.
Yeah, it would make sense. But I hope they don't do that too much of the Gatewatch.
Yeah, as it might be evident, both of us are not particularly happy with the whole Gatewatch storyline. And to be completely honest, I think both of us would be quite happy to see if one of them gets absolutely brutally murdered by Nicol Bolas.
Yep. Please.
Alright, enough about Amonkhet for now. Let's move on to our next topic. This is going to be a bit of a discussion. So, Mardu Vehicles was utterly dominant at the Pro Tour.
I mean, 6 from 8 top 8 decks were Mardu Vehicles. And you could think that it's an overpowered deck that cannot be beaten. But that's not the case. Absolutely not.
Yeah, definitely not.
What was the problem? The problem was it had a good matchup against Black-Green and Saheeli.
Mm-hmm.
Jeskai Saheeli. And yeah, no one expected to be so much Mardu Vehicles. They built, Green-Black built to defeat Saheeli, and Saheeli built to defeat everything else with its stupid combo, and nobody thought about building something against Mardu Vehicles, so they got just crushed.
Yeah, and I mean, basically the step that was taken in preparation for the Pro Tour by most of the pros was to analyze what's good right now, which was Jeskai Saheeli and Black-Green, Aggro, Constrictor, something at that point. And they all wanted to build something that specifically beats these two decks. So the conclusion they came to was, alright, we've got Mardu Vehicles. Now, why does Mardu Vehicles beat Jeskai Saheeli, and why does it beat Green Black Aggro?
Yeah. To be honest, I really don't know. I didn't look at exactly at Mardu Vehicles because I was really salty about the Pro Tour. I was really disappointed. I hoped that there would be a really nice close Pro Tour where the really good decks would emerge, but it was just Mardu Vehicles.
Yeah, I also was left a bit disappointed. We did see a couple of cool decks at the Pro Tour. Like, somebody was playing Aetherflux Reservoir, and a couple of people were playing some kind of improvised deck, but unfortunately they all just got pushed out by Mardu Vehicles. Now, to get back to the question I just asked, it's fairly obvious for Jeskai Saheeli, because we have the usual kind of thing where it's aggro deck versus control deck, and it's especially tough in this case because, thanks to Heart of Kiron, Jeskai Saheeli has a card against it that it has a lot of trouble dealing with. As we all know, Fatal Push was the card that was designed to keep the cheap vehicles like Smuggler's Copter or now Heart of Kiron in check. And Jeskai Saheeli does not have access to Fatal Push, obviously.
Yeah, okay, that's reasonable. But I can also imagine that Mardu Vehicles is just a little bit too aggressive.
Absolutely.
For Jeskai Saheeli. Because you have to... It's not built around the combo. That's obvious. Because you can't build around one combo. But the rest was not enough value against such a strong, aggressive deck.
Yeah, I mean...
And Heart of Kiron is really devastating. Because you can crew it with Planeswalkers, which makes it really, really hard to counter.
Mm-hmm.
You can attack with it, and you can block with it. And
you
don't need a single creature for it.
That is very correct. On top of that, there are a couple of other reasons why Mardu Vehicles is particularly good against Jeskai Saheeli. Now, a usual control deck does one thing very well, or needs to do one thing very well, and that's dealing with opposing threats. One big breakout card of Pro Tour Aether Revolt was, in my opinion at least, Scrap Heap Scrounger.
Oh yeah, this card is just ridiculous. I had it against me at the game day,
mm-hmm.
and I was really at the moment where I realized, shit, I can't do a thing about it.
Yep.
It's too dangerous to keep on board.
Mm-hmm.
And it does absolutely nothing if I kill it, because it just comes back. I have to exile it. And to be honest, which card should I exile?
Yeah.
It has two CMC?
Yep.
So no Transgress the Mind?
Precisely. No, you'd need like Stasis or something like that. But even that is just wildly inefficient. I don't think there's a good way of dealing with Scrap Heap Scrounger in this current standard format. And that's one of the big points why Mardu Vehicles was, and actually still is, very, very good.
Yeah, if you look at the MTG Goldfish meter, it's still number one with 22% of the decks. Followed by, I think, Green-Black... aggro, then Green Black Delirium, then four color Saheeli. It pushed away Jeskai Saheeli, just behind it, and then comes the rest.
So. Yeah. And I also think that one other big thing about Mardu Vehicles that Jeskai Saheeli just could not deal with was something that you already alluded to, which is Gideon, Ally of Zendikar. If you have Heart of Kiron and Gideon, Ally of Zendikar.
Just ridiculous. You can just plus one. You don't even need his ally knight, you just plus one. He has five loyalty. So you crew instantly, attack, swing for three or four, for four, flying, vigilance.
And five on the ground with Gideon.
Yeah, if it's in the next round. So you can attack.
Wait, does he not have haste?
No.
So, oh, that's a bummer.
But it's just enough. You plus one him, crew the Heart of Kirin, attack with flying. You can't block that.
Yeah, and the absolutely mad thing about Gideon, in my opinion, is that when he's a creature, he's just indestructible. And we don't have a Path to Exile or something like that in our format.
We have Stasis Snare. But again,
it's rubbish.
Why would you play that? And think about it. The next turn, he's still there. The Heart of Kirin is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Not tapped. Yeah. And you just go, well, attack. What you gonna do?
Yeah.
I just crew it again. And the next turn, maybe you push out Ella Knight just because. And you can do it again.
Yep, it's
crew to attack, crew to defend. Then you draw your second Gideon, throw it away, put a second Gideon out, and
yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that back when we did spoilers for Aether Revolt, one of the things I said was that Gideon is going to be absolutely nuts in this format, and I think I was proven right.
Yeah,
he is insane.
Yep, and yeah, and as you said, Maru Vehicles has access to black and the strong removal cards.
Yeah, it can run Fatal Push, it can run Unlicensed Disintegration.
And Shock. Shock is devastating for Saheeli.
Absolutely. But yeah, Maru Vehicles, all in all, I mean, if you just look at the list, it's fairly obvious that it is just the perfect counter against Jeskai Saheeli.
Yep. So, why did it well against green-black aggro?
That's a bit more interesting. Now, green-black aggro is a strong deck. No question.
Yeah, you have... If you play green-black aggro, you're in Value Town. You're...
Yes.
You're the headmaster of Value Town. You play a Walking Ballista. Oh my god. Walking Ballista... I don't have other words for it. It's ridiculous.
Yes, let me put it this way. Walking Ballista. So, let's talk about Vintage for a moment, because I love Vintage. Recently, you didn't really see many things played in Vintage outside of Mentor decks with a Monastery Mentor. Do you remember that one from Fate Reforged?
Not that much.
It's 3 mana, 2 and a white, for a 2/2 with prowess, and every time you cast a non-creature spell, you get a 1/1 monk token that also has prowess.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah. Yeah.
So, one strategy that's really popular in Vintage is are the so-called Gush Mentor decks, where you play Monastery Mentor and a bunch of like cheap spells, Mental Misstep, and you play Gush, which you can cast for free if you return 2 islands to your hand and lets you draw 2 cards. Basically, you get a Monastery Mentor on board, you defend it, you cast a bunch of spells, get prowess triggers, get monks, and swing for lethal. That's kind of the basic idea. And this deck was really dominant and really strong over the last year or so in different versions. Now, with the release of Walking Ballista, Workshop decks have suddenly become incredibly good again. So a Workshop is the kind of deck that plays Mishra's Workshop, which gives you 3 mana, but only for artifact spells. It runs cards like Thorn of Amethyst or Sphere of Resistance that make spells more expensive to cast. So the Gush Mentor decks can't cast all of their nonsense for free. And it runs a couple of aggressive, disruptive creatures that try to get the win. And Walking Ballista, just by itself, was good enough to warp the Gush Mentor decks to play main deck Stony Silence.
Holy shit. I mean, just look at the standard. I played against Walking Ballista. I lost against Walking Ballista. Because this card is ridiculous. Just ridiculous. You can't remove it effectively.
Yep.
If you remove it with a Fatal Push, because you can just Fatal Push it away. But if it has three counters on it...
You still get bolted to the face.
Yeah, for three. Or it just bolts your Planeswalkers. It, mm-hmm. it says... No, I want to destroy your creature before it dies. And if you have a Walking Ballista with maybe four counters, you have effectively 8 damage at your face if it attacks. And that's just insane.
Yeah, it's nuts. And I mean, the synergy between Winding Constrictor and Walking Ballista is quite obvious. And it's one of the reasons why black-green aggro gets as much late-game power as it has. Because if you have... Winding Constrictor and a Walking Ballista.
That's... And you've got enough mana to keep activating the Walking Ballista, then it just gets bigger and bigger every turn in the late game.
And to be honest, these two cards are enough to really destroy your board.
Yeah, and now the absolutely mad thing about it is that Mardu Vehicles gets so big so quickly... that a deck like Black-Green Aggro, with all of its +1/+1 counter synergy and its potentially huge creatures, cannot deal with it well.
Yeah, because to be that big, or to become that big in Green-Black Aggro, you need a little bit of time.
Yes.
You need to get at least at the mid-game. You want to push your opponent to the late game, or the end game, and maybe just kill him before that, but... You're at the strongest in the mid game, in the late game. And Mardu Vehicles is just too aggressive. If you put out a Tireless Tracker with a Mining Constrictor, it's really a lot of value.
Yup.
But not strong enough to deal with a Gideon and a Heart of Kirin.
Precisely.
They are flying, Heart of Kirin is flying, and if it swings too fast, you can't react.
Yep. So, like, you're. Sort of ideal curve in black-green aggro would be something like Winding Constrictor into Tireless Tracker into something else, like a Walking Ballista for two or something, into Verdurous Gearhulk. And that's where you go absolutely mad. But that's turn 4 or 5. Turn 4 or 5, your Mardu Vehicles deck has Heart of Kirin, Veteran Motorist, and even a Gideon on the field.
And you're just dead.
Precisely.
Yeah, because a 5/5 flying vigilance that can attack and block is just ridiculous. I mean, sure, you can bolt the Gideon away with the Walking Ballista, but again, turn three maybe. So, yeah, too slow.
Yeah, I mean, the matchup is still, let's say, okay. I'd put it at like 55 for Mardu, 45 for black-green aggro. But it's rough. Mardu Vehicles is really good.
Yeah, as we just saw. So, but why don't we see it anymore? Or not so much?
I think a lot of this has to do with reasons that are actually outside of... the standard metagame. I think one reason is because people have not really been trusting standard anymore, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I totally understand why people don't want to spend so much money on a format that's rotates so fast. Well, maybe not that fast anymore, but it rotates. So it means after a year, your $20 cards are worthless. If you don't have luck that this card is played in Modern or something like that. And yeah, people don't want to buy so expensive decks. Yeah. Card of Kirin is still the most expensive card in the Aether World set. Mm-hmm. Followed by, I think... was it Walking Ballista? I think it's probably. Followed by Walking Ballista, yeah. And then it drops significantly to like $4 for the don't know. Fatal Push, yeah. Push is the $4 card. So, can you imagine? Uncommon is more expensive than most of the rare cards in this set.
Yeah, it's a bit sad. And so, I think a reasonable comparison would maybe be that people are just getting tired of how much Wizards are trying to push Standard and Standard only. I think that's like the huge problem that's happening. Yeah, a lot of people enjoy other formats like Modern, like Legacy, or like Commander. But a lot of the focus of Wizards marketing has only gone into Standard and trying to get people to play Standard.
And they could do it right. So they don't think about the possibilities of the metagame. So a strong metagame has to have strong control deck, a strong aggro deck, and strong other decks, like a good mid-range deck, maybe a strong bullshit deck. I keep forgetting the name of this card.
Aetherflux Reservoir.
Thank you. And you have to... Disalo is good, but quite not good enough.
Yep. It's slow.
It's too slow, and that's the problem. They need to build stronger cards for Standard to be interesting. And that's the problem. They have, I think, it's just a theory, that they fear to make too strong cards for, like, Commander, where Commander people would go absolutely nuts if they see, oh my god, they printed that. Are they insane? And Modern players,
I'd
like...
Yeah, I'd love that.
Yeah, but that would be healthy. So you have your Ultra Mythics, like the Inventions, that just keeps people to open boxes, and then you got good cards. And the people go like, whoa, I need 2 cases of this set, because there are so amazing cards in there.
I need like 5 play sets of this card.
Yeah, just because. And that's a problem. Why don't they do that? As strong as a Standard would be more interesting, and I would say more accessible, because, again, more people would buy more boxes, would open the shit out of them, and the market would be flooded with more cards.
Definitely.
Which is good. Because, to be honest, all the elitists out there, you should feel bad. Really. Because Magic should be for everyone. And everyone should be able to play a good deck and not spend, like, don't know, half of his earnings in a month for that.
Yeah.
And as we said, Mardu Vehicles, you need Heart of Kiran, which costs 13 euros a card. Gideon, which costs 20, and other stuff. And then you are at 200, 300 if you have to buy everything. So,
and that's a lot for Standard.
Yeah, that's too much.
Of course, people were complaining about Banned Company in Standard, which costed like $700 and more. But that's not really a comparison. Like, 700 is way too much, but 300 is still a lot too much.
Yeah. My opinion would be maybe 150 at maximum 200 euros if you have to build it from the ground, from scratch. If you need really every card.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, you draft, like, if you're an average Magic player, you draft 1-2 times a month, maybe buy a box for yourself, and you have most of the cards. So you need maybe to spend 100 euros to get the other cards, but that's okay, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But that's not the case at the moment.
That's correct. Now, it is good that they've taken some measures against it, as we said earlier, with the whole Masterpiece series. But coming back to the topic of, like, bad cards in Standard, in a way, I think this is where not having the core sets anymore really hurt the format. Because core sets were the space where you could reprint or, like, print new good generic cards, like good removal, good generic artifacts, all of that kind of stuff.
Just look at Origins. Languish. Perfect. It was a really nice card.
Or Jace Vryn's Prodigy.
Oh my god.
Vintage playable.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's insane that this card costs 50 euros. It costed 50 euros, and I think it got back to 30 because of Frontier.
Yeah, it went down to like 22, 25, which is where I got mine, and then went back up to like 35 because of Frontier, and now it's back down to like 30 again.
Yeah, but if we take like these Ultra Mythics in such a box, then it would be opened a lot more, and again, the card would drop a little bit in price.
Mm-hmm.
But it's absolutely okay to have such a strong card.
Yeah.
Because you need strong cards to make a format interesting. That's why I would love to play Legacy or Vintage, but it's just too expensive, to be honest.
Sadly, yeah.
I could buy a car or a Vintage deck. I decided to buy a car.
But yeah, see, that's why I play competitive EDH. I mean, it's still really expensive. But
yeah, if you have to buy dual lands, but the dual lands are an investment. Definitely. If you buy one, you spend maybe 100 euros, but it's still worth 100 euros.
And you only need to buy one.
Yeah, and if you have one, you can go, oh, well, okay, I don't like my deck anymore, or I want to change it a little bit, or discard, I don't know. And you can say, that's not a problem, I still have this card for another deck. Because are absolutely absolute staples, the original dual lands, for example, fetch lands.
Yeah, I feel like that's a thing that's been going on with a lot of, like, even deeply enfranchised players lately. Because I've been noticing it about myself. Like, I've been looking at Standard. I've been thinking, okay, I'm either not going to play Standard or I'm going to play some kind of meme deck. And I'm just going to play Commander instead.
And that's, in my opinion, absolutely okay and understandable. Because I like to play new decks. I like to play with new cards in a limited environment, so that I don't have to confront every card in the Magic history. So I can say, okay, he plays white, he could have a Gideon, he could have whatever, and I don't have to open my textbook and look, okay, what are the strong cards on white in the Magic history? And that's my point. That's why I like to play Standard, and I work so I can afford it. I can absolutely understand if somebody says I don't want to spend so much money, and that's okay. Yeah, for that, you have EDH. You don't have to spend that much money either on EDH to have fun.
Absolutely.
And to make absolutely cool decks. I mean, the casual deck of one of your admins is the red deck. That's absolutely stupid. Absolutely fun. I saw it and I thought, well, why not? It's not expensive, I think, but it's fun.
Definitely.
And that's, to be honest, is the whole point of Magic. And winning. Winning is fun. But yeah, having fun. So to come back to the actual Standard meta game, it's not fun. Not really. Because they're missing a lot of strong cards, especially in blue.
Yeah.
Blue, I don't like blue. You're the essence of blue. I am the essence of I hate blue. But I still think that blue is way too weak.
Yeah, it's been a rough couple of years for blue, with the exception of like fringe cards. I mean, you can take Paradoxical Outcome, which is absolutely ridiculous in Vintage, or you can take, oh god, I don't know, are there any other good blue cards right now?
In the last 2 years? Nah.
Ceremonious Rejection is Vintage sideboard playable, but that's about it.
Yeah. I don't say, we don't say that every set has to be absolutely insane in value.
Yeah, no, definitely not.
But it would be good if every color gets some kind of strong card. And maybe we could go back to specific strategies, like, okay, this card is absolutely insane, but it only works in one deck.
Mm-hmm.
And this deck is strong, but it has a counter deck.
Yeah.
And that would be really nice, and I think the people at Wizards can't be stupid.
Definitely not.
They're making the game for over 20 years, and it works, and it's really well made, to be honest. The rulings are beautiful and really clear. And that's the point. I don't understand why they don't do that.
I think part of it has to do with sort of the type of philosophical thinking the current lead designers subscribe to. Because as is the case with almost any kind of game design, as I've also experienced myself, there are a lot of different ways to think about the same thing. So, for a simple example, if you want to make a platformer game, there are like 20 different ways in which you could make your character get from one platform to another. And while one way isn't necessarily better than the other, you can still do it differently depending on how you personally feel about it. And you have to make that choice at some point, and you have to commit to it. So they've probably made a conscious decision to form standard in a certain way at some point, and they are now seeing the effect of that change in philosophy. What that means is that at some point they will also be able to change their views again and go to a different sort of design philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And also, the new standard rotation just needs a little bit more time. Because if you out there don't know it, the sets are designed 2 years before they even come out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of work done before anything happens. So they have to forge standard 2 years in hindsight. So
yeah,
that's difficult. I can really understand how difficult it is.
Yeah, I mean,
but at the same moment, yeah, as I said, some points I really don't understand.
Yeah.
I can't agree with that.
We'll see how it'll turn out in the future.
Yeah, I'm absolutely hyped for Amon Kett. So
definitely. I think it's going to be a great set.
I just hope that Nicol Bolas kicks ass.
Yes, please. Okay, we've been going on a lot about Mardu Vehicles now. However, we do have one final thing prepared. It's sort of a typical thing that we do. We look at deck lists and judge them, as we said. So today, we are going to be looking at Blue-Red Emerge.
Yeah. Or Grixis. Why Grixis? Oh yeah, the Pressed Amalgam.
Yeah. That's literally the only black card in the entire deck.
Okay, then it's just Blue-Red Emerge. So how we do it? We look from the top to the bottom at the cards. We say, okay, this card has this function in this deck. It works well with that and blah, blah, blah. And then we look at the sideboard and see, okay, he has a good matchup against this deck if he effectively uses a sideboard this way and whatever. So before we talk too much again, we just start.
Okay. I'll just take it from the top here. Now, the first thing we've already mentioned, it's 4 copies of Prized Amalgam. I think we should mention 2 other creatures in this deck along the same lines, and that's 4 copies of Stitchwing Scab and 3 copies of Advanced Stitchwing. Now, what do all of these cards have in common?
They return every single time. It doesn't matter what you do to them, except for exile them, but that's not a meta game thing. It's not effective to do anything with that. You can't leave it on the board because it's too dangerous, but you can't kill them either because they just return. And the Priced Amalgam is a master in that.
Oh, yes.
If you use the two Wretched Griffs and the four Elder Deep Fiends to sacrifice them to the higher cause, to say it that way, it doesn't matter. If you... It's absolutely... You're again at value town. If you sacrifice a Priced Amalgam for your Elder Deep Fiend, tap your enemy out, maybe you can do another thing and bring all your Priced Amalgams back on the field, and you have an Elder Deep Fiend. You have no mana. Your opponent has no mana, and you have maybe two or three Priced Amalgams ready to fuck your shit up.
Yeah, pretty much. So, I mean, Priced Amalgam has also been seeing modern play in Dredge, simply because it's just so damn good. And we've got Stitchwing Scab and Advanced Stitchwing that can easily return from our graveyard, because all you really need to do is discard a card or two and pay a bit of mana. The insane thing about this is that for what little mana you pay, you get so much. Because, I mean, just look at Stitchwing Scab. It's in your graveyard. You pay one and a blue and discard two cards that maybe even want to be in your graveyard. You get a 3-1 flyer, and at the end of your turn, you get like a Priced Amalgam or two. And this happens every turn. And on top of that, you've got mana open to cast all of your spells, like Lightning Axe or...
Which is perfect in the strategy, because Lightning Axe, to be effectively used, you need to discard a card. And that's what you want to do. You have a Priced Amalgam on your hand, you don't want to hard cast it, you want to throw it away. And the Lightning Axe is perfect.
Absolutely.
The four copies of Cathartic Reunion, the Power Tormenting Voice or the Turbo Tormenting Voice, it's just perfect.
Yeah, it's
and
lovely.
If you look, Tormenting Voice, obviously, three Fiery Temper, which is the value. Oh,
unsurprising.
God. Yeah.
The incredible thing about all of this, especially Fiery Temper, is that thanks to Fiery Temper being in there, this deck has a lot of game against Jeskai Saheeli or any other Saheeli combo build, because what you can do is you've got a Stitchwing Scab or Advanced Stitchwing in your graveyard and a Fiery Temper in your hand. You can now, at instant speed, discard Fiery Temper to cast it via Madness.
Yeah, and you get an Advanced Stitchwing or a Stitching Scab back. Other bullshit. And you have four Kozilek's Return, which is perfect for the Elder Deep Fiend. If you think all the time, well, nice, but how do you get all these cards? Wait right there, there's more. You have four copies of Fevered Visions in the main deck, and this is absolutely lovely.
Yeah, I love that. It's so good in this deck, because, I mean, the obvious first thought everyone has when it comes to having to discard a lot of cards is, how am I going to refuel? And Fevered Visions is perfect for that.
Because it's cheap for its effect.
Yeah.
It's in the colors. It's in colors you play. And it hasn't a downside like most of such cards, because you are the first to draw.
Precisely. As opposed to Howling Mine, which gets people an additional draw effect on their draw step, you draw on your end step, which means that, as you said, you're going to be the first one to draw. And there's even another upside. You also make your opponent draw. And if they have four or more cards in their hand, which is fairly likely, they get shocked in the face.
Oh, yeah. And to add to that, if you have two Fevered Visions, for you, it doesn't matter. You just keep discarding your cards, because you have so many discard outlets. If you throw away your Advanced Stitchwings, you just throw away two other cards, like Fiery Temper or a Priced Amalgam, whatever. And... Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't matter, but for your opponent, it matters if he's flooded with cards in his hand. He can't play.
To be fair, if your opponent also gets to draw a lot of cards, they are going to have their best cards fairly quickly. But that doesn't really matter, because their best cards are probably not going to be able to get through a bunch of reanimated creatures each turn. I mean, we've already talked about how Scrap Heap Scrounger is just absolutely ridiculous, and now we've basically got a deck that runs 11 Scrap Heap Scroungers.
Yep. Exactly. Should we have a little quick look at the land base? He plays only 23 lands. That's interesting.
Makes sense to
me. Makes sense, and it's interesting too, because the normal state is 24 to 26. And yeah.
For non-aggro decks, but I think this could firmly be considered an aggro deck.
Yeah. The most interesting parts are maybe the Sanctum of Ugin, which makes absolutely sense if you want your Elder Deep Fiend fast enough.
And in multiples.
Yeah, and maybe also the Wandering Female Role, because man lands are awesome.
Yeah, it's really good. I like it. To have a quick look at the sideboard, we maybe don't need to go over everything, but there's an additional Sanctum of Ugin in there. This is cool, because if he needs to play a really long game, like if he can't properly get through something like a hard control deck, like the blue-black control deck that was played by Jim Davis at one of the recent SCG Opens, then he boards in another Sanctum of Ugin to have even more gas in the late game.
Exactly. Then we have two copies of Ceremonious Rejection. That's absolutely understandable. Mm. You play blue, why not have counters in your sideboard?
Yeah.
An additional Lightning Axe, also okay. Two Seems shocks, good. Four negates, absolutely understandable. What does it counter against?
Non-creature.
Non-creature spells, which are Planeswalkers, for example.
Yeah.
You got an additional Fiery Temper, Nahiri's Wrath, which
That's
is
cool.
interesting.
That's really good, though, because the CMC of all of these creatures that we already want to discard is fairly high. It goes from 3 to 5. So what you can do with Nahiri's Wrath is you can empty your hand all in one go and deal a lot of damage to your opponent's board.
So simply wipe it.
Yeah.
And that's good against green-black aggro if you have really big creatures out, like the Walking Ballista maybe. It doesn't change much because the Walking Ballista can still shock you in the face or even bolt you in the face or worse before it dies, but it's enough to just clear the board.
Yeah. Chandra, Torch of Defiance is a very interesting inclusion in my opinion because it basically is a testament towards decks that are able to consistently empty their hand even with a Fevered Visions or two. Because that's the point where you board in Chandra in order to get even more card advantage than your opponent.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's a little bit risky for the plus one with Exile the top card, and you can cast it for its cost. And that's the risky part. If you can't, it's exiled. And you're in trouble, because you don't want your cards to be exiled.
Yeah, you don't really want to exile, like, a prized amalgam or something.
So, yeah, sure, you have to make sure that you can cast a prized amalgam in the worst case. Because you really don't want it to land in the exile zone.
Yeah. Sort of a joke that's been going on with this deck is that in your ideal game, you never want to cast a creature spell.
Yeah. That's true. An additional copy of Ratchet Griff, and that's the sideboard.
Yeah, so why did we choose this deck? I think it's quite obvious. We have already mentioned Scrap Heap Scrounger being a big problem, and just big indestructible creatures, and or flying vigilant creatures, being an issue, and this deck deals with all of them. It has a fantastic matchup against Mardu Vehicles, because the Stitchwing Scab and the Advanced Stitchwing both fly, both can block the Heart of Kirin. We've got the Prized Amalgam to deal with Scrap Heap Scrounger, and the funny thing about this is that if you compare Prized Amalgam and Scrap Heap Scrounger, Prized Amalgam has an even better sort of efficiency rate than Scrap Heap Scrounger. For the Scrounger, you need to pay 2 mana to bring it back, while Prized Amalgam comes back for free.
And I think exile a creature card in your graveyard.
Yeah, and that.
So it's obvious why you can't play the Scrap Heap Scrounger in this deck. You don't want to exile your creatures.
Mm-hmm.
That's just counter-effective. And Prized Amalgam returns just much faster and much more aggressive.
Yeah.
Because all of them return if just anything returns from your graveyard.
Pretty much, yeah. He just keeps coming back. And it's not too unnatural to think that when you play this against Mardu Vehicles, the game is sort of going to devolve into who can bring more stuff back from the graveyard quicker. And that's where this deck has the upper hand.
Exactly.
Also, Unlicensed Disintegration and Fatal Push do absolutely nothing against this deck.
Yeah, just as we said at the beginning, normal removal doesn't do nothing. It does do nothing against this deck.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you have a Fumigate and killed all anything? Well,
wow.
Wow, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
You wipe my board? Thank you. It's just like, I Fatal Pushed a Scrap Heap Scrounger away at the game day,
mm-hmm.
and my opponent was like, okay, thank you. So, and it was like, I know, but I can't keep it on the board.
Pretty much, and that's the whole theme of this deck, and it's working out fantastically. I mean, it even does the same thing against, Green-Black.
Oh, yeah.
Because it doesn't matter if your opponent has, like, a 10-9 tireless tracker or something, you can just keep bringing your guys back.
Yep.
But yeah, that's... Yep. I don't think there's a lot more to say. It's definitely a cool deck. Feel free to check it out or sleeve it up and take it to your Friday Night Magic or something.
Yeah. What Wizard is doing right now is they're really pushing the standard game in their local game stores.
Mm-hmm.
You get special prizes and special cards for attending.
Ooh, right.
At six standard tournaments,
yeah.
at your local game store.
Aren't they bringing the standard showdown back, basically?
Yeah, most likely. And this is a cool deck. It's cheap. If you have to buy everything, you just pay around, let's say 200 euros. But to be honest, most of the cards there you already have.
Yeah.
Maybe the most expensive card is Kozilek's Return, and you can easily trade them at your local game store if you want to. And you don't have to play the two Chandras in your sideboard.
Yeah. If you're just going to FNM, then you don't need two Chandras in your sideboard, honestly.
Yeah, you have to sideboard against your metagame, so you can't take this sideboard, to be honest. You have to make your own against your friends.
Absolutely. I agree 100% with that, and that making your own sideboard and adapting it to your meta is also a thing that helps you grow as a deck builder, because you analyze your metagame, you identify the things that threaten your deck, and you actively work to find cards that work against those threats.
Yep. And that's why you're the better deck builder than me. Yeah.
I try.
Yeah. I think we have it for this week.
Yeah, that's all for today. I hope you all enjoyed our very first English Magic Tavern podcast. There's going to be more to come, but before we leave, I think there's one final discussion we should have. Is this going to be episode 1, number 2, or is this going to be episode 33?
Yeah. So should we continue it, or should we start from scratch with episode one of the English Magic Tavern?
I honestly have no idea.
Okay, we can maybe took it from the puns that we make. Most of the puns were German. They were all in German, because
that's what we do.
Yeah. They have to make sense for the German listeners. But no, we have no boundaries. We can do every bad pun that exists out there. It's wonderful.
That being said, though, I am a bit sad because when it comes to English, most of them have already been done.
Yeah, but
for German, we could at least come up with our own stuff.
Yeah, but to be quite honest, the English puns are better.
That much is probably true.
Yeah, so I'm most likely to say we are at episode one. Because we start a new cycle of bad puns.
So, episode one it is. All right. You've heard it here first, or probably read it before you even started listening to the podcast. But this is going to be episode one of the Magic Tavern. We're not going to change the orthography of our name. It's just going to have a silent E from now on.
Yeah, just because.
And with that, I'd say we're all going to see each other next week again.
Yeah, until then.
Goodbye.